Central Synagogue in New York.
And I'm Rabbi Sarah Berman, and I'm thrilled to get to speak with Livia Thompson. Hi, Livia.
Hi, Sarah. Hi, Jill.
So, Livia, I'd love to begin at the beginning. What is your earliest Jewish memory?
I'm really not sure. I would say that among my earliest memories are Passover Seders at my grandmother's apartment in Brookline, Massachusetts, with a lot of family, endless chatter, and very good kosher food.
Very good kosher food. What did that look like? What did that taste like?
My grandmother was a very traditional, very traditional cook. So it was, you know, brisket, overcooked vegetables. When we went, I know this isn't about Seder. It must have been when we were there for the high holidays, because she was a really great mandel bread baker, fabulous mandel bread. And kishka varnikas and potatoes and sort of heavy, dense food, homemade challah, homemade chicken soup. She actually still made homemade gefilte fish when I was little. Later, oh, wow. she took the gefilte fish from the jar, poured it out into a soup tureen, and fussed with it for a couple of hours, and then put it back in. The other thing about my grandmother, which is not about being Jewish, but is a very important part of my memory, is when my father was 2 weeks old, my grandmother and my grandfather, who I never knew, hired a woman named Ethel Devlin, who was a very young Irish American, came from Boston. And Evelyn and Ethel took care of my dad, who was very sickly growing up, his entire childhood up to age 18. He went off to college and then got married. Ethel stayed taking care of my grandmother until my grandmother went into a nursing home, made Shabbat dinner with her and then for her all the way through, refused to give up seeing her multiple times a week, even when my grandmother was not in a financial position to pay. I'm not even sure that Ethel at that point would have taken money. And when my grandmother at age 94 and 95 was in a nursing home in Brookline, Ethel continued to visit her until my grandmother's death. So she's wound up in that memory of the Jewish experience that I had with my grandmother.
How extraordinary. I love that she made Shabbat for your grandma when your grandmother could no longer do it for herself and her family. This woman from an Irish background doing that.
Yeah.
Oh, incredible. I mean, we are talking, our point of connection is Central Synagogue, because you used to be the executive director. So at some point, Jewish community shifted from, you know, your grandmother's house and the Seder table to a career for you. How did that happen?
I think to everyone's surprise, including mine, it was not what I grew up to be. I was raised in a conservative household. I did go to religious school 3 days a week, like a good traditional conservative Jew, right? 2 hours Monday, 2 hours Wednesday, 4 hours on Sunday.
Oh, yeah.
We had a kosher light household, but a very involved ritually Jewish household. But when I went off to college, I actually explored Quakerism and many other things, like, you know, a good college person should do, and really wrestled with what it meant to be a Jew and how I wanted to be Jewish. And I became a lawyer and was off in a legal career. around the same time as I met and married my husband, Tom Thompson, former Methodist, now whatever he is, but not Methodist and not Jewish. I had decided to leave private practice and found a job at the Anti-Defamation League in the Civil Rights Division. And that's really when I started my Jewish journey as a professional. I loved working in a Jewish institution. It was, there was something very comfortable and comforting about the rituals that wove into our work, even though it wasn't like a synagogue or anything that was actively practicing, but Abe Foxman would always walk down the hall and wish everyone a good Shabbos on Fridays. The rhythm slowed down Fridays as people sort of prepared to go home. We all were very conscious of the clock of the Jewish year. In many of the things that I did, while they were grounded in the United States Constitution and in secular questions, there was always a Jewish component to what we were doing, and a very strong awareness of why, as Jews, we had an obligation to do the work we were doing. And at the same time, I started to have children. So that, I would say, those two things in tandem really made me have to define what it meant to be a Jew and how I wanted to be a Jew. I helped found a chavara in my Brooklyn neighborhood, which did not have a synagogue. My husband was very supportive of that, and of being engaged with our children, even if it wasn't his belief. And so that made it easier. And I had a gap between working at Anti-Defamation League and working at Central Synagogue, but it didn't, my continuing questioning about what it meant to be a Jew didn't stop just because I wasn't working at a Jewish institution. And the chair of the search committee for Central Synagogue is somebody that I know Jill knows well, a man named Paul Roth, very longtime member of Central Synagogue. And he was having a meal with his brother-in-law and was complaining about not having found the person they wanted for the role. And Howard Berkowitz, his brother-in-law, said, "Well, I know somebody who worked for ADL. She left, but I think she might be interested. Let me give her a call." So he gave me a call, and he caught me on one of those days when I was a little restless, and I said I would talk to Paul. And you don't know Paul, but Jill does. Paul is very persuasive. Told me I really needed to talk to Rabbi Peter Rubenstein, who I think you both know is extremely persuasive. And
I think taking no for an answer is not in his blood.
I think that's right. And so by the end of a lengthy period where we both kind of looked at each other and said, "Are we willing to take the risk?" For them, they were taking a risk with a young woman who did not know anything about Reform Judaism. I had done a little management, a little this, a little that I could kind of say I had some experience, but definitely a lot of challenges. And I was taking a risk because I wasn't sure this was the world I wanted to be in as my next professional step. And I didn't really understand I didn't understand what the job was. Still, we left, and that was I started in February of 1993 at Central. And I would say it's, among many things, wonderful aspects of being at Central, it did allow me to continue my own personal journey about what it meant to be a Jew and about being educated as a Jew, and sharing that experience with lots of wonderful people was pretty great.
So working at the ADL is, you know, that's kind of professional Judaism. That is, yeah, you know, real kind of professional, I mean, easily understood professional work. But working in a synagogue is totally different. That's community for so many people. But there, of course, it takes a professional staff to create that community, especially in a place like Central. So I'm really curious how your Jewish identity maybe changed or evolved while being on the staff in a synagogue.
Yeah, I think that's really a great distinction. Because when I came into Central, at first, I actually kept my personal Jewish journey, my children, completely separate from the Central Synagogue experience. We lived in Brooklyn. We lived a very different kind of life from what I understood the life of many of the congregants was at Central Synagogue. And for geographic and other reasons, it just didn't make sense. And so what I did as a Jew at home and what I did as a professional in Central were really distinct. And when I was started to realize that that was a loss, that there was an enormous value to becoming a member as deepening relationships within Central, that made me a better professional, but it also provided a lot of joy. And I hope provided joy to the people that I was in relationship with. That really had a profound impact on my own sort of sense of being a Jew. And I agree that I think, and it's something when I talk to young professionals in the work that I did at Central, and some of whom I've been able to mentor over the years, I talk about how you have to find that delicate balance, and that there's great joy in being in community. You also need to understand when you have to draw a line because you do have a professional responsibility.
Right. Well, and you mentioned that you had your family and you kept your family and your kids separate for a while, but not, you know, you did bring these two worlds together at some point. So how did your family relate to the Central community and to your work and, you know, Livia executive director versus your mom?
Yeah. I mean, when I say I brought them into it, it was, I developed a habit. They had to come regularly with me to Friday night services when they were growing up, when they got old enough to be on the subway by themselves, which meant 10, 11 with my kids. And so that was a time when we would then go and have dinner or there was a wonderful Indian restaurant. I don't know if it's still there on 55th Street. That was a great favorite. So, you know, a little bribery was always helpful, but it was also a way for them to see me in my workplace in a different way, and to be introduced to people who were important to me. My family's always been extremely supportive, respectful, and proud of the work that I do. All three of the girls strongly identify as Jews in their own right. Very politically active Jews for whom Judaism is a path to be able to express things that they believe in very strongly. For Tom, it became a place where he could be comfortable with people that he saw and knew and liked. So I would say it was a slow evolutionary process for the many years that I was there.
What was the biggest change in the Central community during your time? And that could be professionally and, you know, in processes and standards and policies, or just in the nature of the community, prayer, anything in your time, what changed the most?
You know what? I'm about to get a lot of vacuum cleaning in my ear. Can I take a moment? Can we stop and just stop the recording for a moment so I can walk downstairs? Does that work?
I think we need to keep the recording going.
Oh.
But yeah, we can just pause our interview.
Okay. As well, yeah. Whatever works for you. I just want to not have a recording that's full of.
We appreciate that.
Okay, can you hear me now?
I do love watching a person move through a space that has more than two rooms. Nope, can't hear you yet. Can you hear us? Okay. So we just need to get you a mic again or something.
All right.
Yeah. Perfect.
Now, except now I'm on twice.
There we go. Oh, this is the one. This is the you without. Hang on. No. Try again. Olivia, if you speak again, let's see. No, we still don't have your sound. Okay. Let's see. So maybe, yes, we end this recording and. So if you see on your screen towards the top of it next to the recording number, you'll see a microphone icon. If you click on that, it should let you set your mic input. And there might be a default option there. Starting a new user would be great. You just need to close the tab that you are on right now to do that. So just clicking on the link again and then closing this tab.
Yes.
Perfect.
Excellent. Yes.
All right. Sorry about that. I had my Yeti mic attached, and when I unplugged it, I couldn't get my mic to just say no, it's okay.
Just need to, okay. The technology needs a little coaxing sometimes.
So sorry about that.
So I was going to ask you, what was the biggest change in the central community in your time with us?
I would almost say what didn't change, because from 1993 to when I left in 2016. There was almost no aspect of life at Central Synagogue that didn't change. The easiest is probably to say ritual, which went through an enormous evolution at every level. from a lot of organ and a very large 8-person choir singing from on high in a vaguely Protestant way to a much more musically diverse, participatory, much, you know, smaller, very powerful, but smaller set of musicians, generally four singers, multiple musicians, bringing them down from the organ loft to the front of the bima. So everything about the music changed. In addition, because we had had a fire that had seriously damaged the synagogue in 1998, it gave us an opportunity to rethink sound, light, and physical space. And so we opened up the bima by dropping literally a wall of column of sort of a short wall of very thick colonnaded design work that separated the clergy from the people. And in addition, the clergy were on high on the way to the bima, and the people were very low below. The sound system that we had before the fire was horrible, so that you couldn't actually hear very well if you were in the back. And the lighting was very dim. And the pews were very uncomfortable because they were too short. They had been built in 1870s for 1870s bodies. So all of those physical changes also were important in creating a much more cohesive, much more engaged, much more the members and the clergy are together praying and singing and engaging. Also, the bima was redesigned, and the design of the ark, which used to look when you opened it like a very large breast.
We just found the textile that used to hang in there.
Yeah, it was I don't remember it being a textile as much as it was actually a physical manifestation of a breast, and it was in fact intended to be to have that suggestion because of the Torah being, you know, so near and dear to our heart, right? Mm-hmm. So that was, but it was a very it was very dark and very forbidding. If you were if the ark was open, it didn't draw you in. And I think now with the design, the tapestry design we have, and the very beautiful sort of visual images of sparks of the divine on the Torah mantles, I think that's really changed. So all of that, and I could keep going, having a hakafah, the sharing of joy, the having people acknowledge life cycles in very personal ways, the ease and comfort and relaxation of, oh, the clergy up on the bima are, they're trained, they're really knowledgeable, but they're also people who can, we can feel their peoplehood, right? In a way that wasn't the case, not wearing robes, all of it. And to me, the impact of the ritual is a reflection of all of the other kinds of changes that happened at Central. So Central both became more professional in terms of growth of staff, growth of level of technical level of expertise and excellence that was demanded and achieved, I think, through the hiring of amazing staff people, but also became very committed to engaging broadly with the community. And those things aren't inconsistent. They just allow each to do their best job, I think. So that happened over the course of time. And the commitment that Peter as senior rabbi had to continue to question and push and ask and not ever be satisfied. He's infamous for saying, if it's not broke, break it. And I'm not sure I would agree quite as far as he was willing to do, but that was partly my role versus his role. But I think it was, it allowed for an institution to become much more lively, much more dynamic, much more questioning, much more committed to the Judaism of today than it was before Peter came. And lastly, I would say the community has become more diverse. It was very much an Upper East Side community when I first came. It was part of my angst in deciding to come because I was not a Upper East Side sort of girl. And I wasn't sure how I would be received and whether I would feel like I could, you know, I could be part of that community, could add value. So we all changed. And I think the community is such an amazing group of people and reflects sort of more the diversity of the Jewish community today than it did then. And lastly, I would say the way that we think about, that Central thinks about education and community, and formal and informal, and it's all intertwined. When I first came to Central, we had a school, religious school, right? We had a nursery school. We had a youth group, but we didn't have this sense that one flows in from the other and that you need all of it happening together in order to make a difference. So
all of those things that happened, it really sounds like they were entirely focused on making the community feel more connected, making kids feel more connected, parents feel more connected, people in worship feel more connected, the clergy feel more connected. Yeah. That's something that I think today Central is so known for, but it came from somewhere. There were choices that were made in order to create this.
Yeah, I mean, there were some very pivotal points. One is we had always been known for a beautiful historic building. By the way, very shabby by the 1990s, very sure. Shabby, but we had been known for it. And it was beautiful and still is beautiful. And in fact, our stationery to this day, I think the Central Synagogue stationery, right, still sort of celebrates the turrets of that building. At the time before the fire, we were actually arguing, is maybe not too strong a word, should we completely get rid of that iconography because we no longer wanted to be known as the place with the beautiful building. We didn't want members to join because of the beautiful building. We wanted to build community in a different way, and we were struggling a little bit, and the fire propelled that conversation because all of a sudden we were a synagogue without that beautiful building for 3 years. And we were really worried members would leave, that we wouldn't get new members. And you know what? We grew every year during those 3 years, enormous growth. And so I would say that, you know, sometimes things are thrust on you. That was just an act that required us to do what we needed to do anyway, which is to shift to being about building relationships. And at the same time, and I can't recall now exactly when we started this, so forgive me, but we heard about this amazing program that had been run from Temple Israel in Boston with a very dynamic rabbi, Jonah Pesner, who who had just come to URJ, or maybe he was still, I don't remember. And he was looking to partner with some synagogues in New York to see whether or not this model of engagement, small groups could happen elsewhere. And we were really interested. And even though there were a number of people who were terrified as we started to explore this, because you just didn't know at that time, the idea that Jews would be willing to meet in small groups in people's houses and talk about profound issues and do that every month and do it without a rabbi in the room, it seemed really wacky, really out there, which is funny to think now when it's become so commonplace. But at the time, it was a big, big deal that we committed to do this. And so that was another major point. We were open to it, but we also learned so much from the work of Esther Letterman and Jonah, and there were some others whose names I'm forgetting, right? Joy Friedman and others. Wonderful, wonderful people who really made a difference. And then I would say, and then, you know, throughout this, you had this very dynamic clergy team that understood profoundly that the world had changed and the role that Judaism had in people's lives had changed and the way to be Jewish had changed and that we needed to keep exploring options. And then we started to have educators that were able to translate that into rethinking the way education works, and the relationship between engagement and a different way of helping people be Jewish. And lastly, because I haven't talked about it, but it's really important, you had a board that was open and supportive and helpful and enthusiastic and wanted to see Central continue to grow and were extremely extremely supportive of some of the crazinesses that the staff came up with and willing to just let things continue to grow. So it became a positive spiral. People came to us because they started to hear we were doing this. We did more of it because we saw the benefits for the community. And then with some of the really amazing clergy leaders that came in over the last 10 to 15 years for whom this was apple pie, because they had gone to school or been in communities where this was already happening. It just kept growing.
You mentioned a couple of times in passing the fire, and you know our community is very well aware of the fire, but nobody else was in the position you were in on that day and in that time. Can you talk about how you felt, what you remember hearing first and experiencing, what you thought, what you felt?
Yeah, I mean, I had actually left, it was August 28th, 1998, and I had left a little early because I was about to go away for my 40th birthday weekend with my family. It was a big deal, birthday, big deal. I walked in the door and my husband said, "I think you need to go back. There's been a fire at Central Synagogue," or "there is a fire at Central Synagogue." So I literally like threw something down and turned around and raced back and got out of the subway and it was still on fire and the trucks were everywhere. I found Rabbi Rubenstein and some of the lay leadership. And we stood there and watched as we also agreed that services should happen and they should be moved to the community house. And so Rabbi Reines and Rabbi Davidson, I believe, were the two rabbis who went downstairs and conducted services. Peter and I stood and waited, and Martin Klein was president at the time. I know he was there on the weekend. I just don't recall right now whether he was there, but lots of board members and members started to show up. other clergy colleagues, other executive director colleagues. That evening was, you know, it was a very long evening, but it was also a very communal evening in that we felt all of the people who were there to support us. Just as an aside, sort of a funny component of that, to the extent you can say that, was I called my husband and said, okay, I'm not coming home. I need to be able to go to services tomorrow morning because we wanted to make sure that we were there for the community. Can you pull out a sleeveless black dress for the summer? And oh, and bring a jacket as well. And he pulled out about three dresses and three jackets, all of which were varieties of cocktail dresses, and it turned out, because he didn't really know better. And so I ended up wearing a cocktail dress and a cocktail jacket to services on Shabbat morning, which was the only funny part of that day. The fire was out some point that night. We didn't get in until I think we went in early the next morning. And you know, first of all, it wasn't clear if it was safe to go in. Second of all, we walked in and you looked up and there was no ceiling. And there were two of the very large beams, wooden beams that held up the roof, had pierced through the floor near the bima, heading down to what's now, it's funny, the word that came up was Omen, which is the old name for the downstairs area.
The pavilion,
yes, which used to be called the Omen Center or something like that. Anyway, and it was black and sooty, and it was still sort of steaming, and there was just disaster everywhere. And that was a pretty intense, pretty sad, pretty devastating moment. Peter never wavered. Peter was always clear, we're going to rebuild, and that we just had to figure out how were we going to do it, what were we going to do, and what was the time frame. Holidays were less than 2 weeks away. And so we ended up getting special permission by Governor Pataki to use the armory because we were a religious institution. Bruce Schlechter and his daughter and I ended up being this crazy team figuring out the logistics with lots of other people helping, but the three of us were kind of this buzzy group that were trying to, you know, make the pieces fly. We were meeting regularly with the lay leadership. We had extremely generous members who provided funding immediately to help both with the initial work that had to be done to secure the building. We had to completely scaffold it and hope that we got the scaffolding up before the walls came down. And we got the armory done in a way that both were, we hired Robert Isabel. Unfortunately, he died relatively young, but he was an amazingly creative party planner, and he planned an incredible high holiday party for us. Another just sort of funny piece was I wasn't sleeping very much in those days. And I also needed to be around for all of the holidays. And I was offered through a congregant a room at the, what's that very nice? No. The
Regency.
Is it the Regency on 57 between Park and Madison, a very nice hotel. So I would, in the 3 or 4 hours that I had between one thing or another, I would get to at least go back into this beautiful room and this wonderful shower. And I appreciated just that little bit of, again, you it was such an intense time. You had to kind of find those moments and enjoy them. And that led to 3 years of exploration of who are we, what are we, how do we move forward? How do we make our members understand that we're a community, even if we don't have a particular building? And what do we want of that building when we come back? What does it mean to think about that space as both sacred and historic, but also needing to meet current needs? It's still a building you fight with a little bit to make it meet current needs, but I think Central has done a really amazing job of continuing to have that good fight in a positive way and be loyal to the history and loyal to the future at the same time.
So I think there's time maybe for two more questions. What are you most proud of accomplishing in your time at Central? And I guess the flip side of that, it's not my second question, but the flip side of that is, do you feel like you left anything undone?
I'm most proud of being part of a renaissance of a community that was floundering in the early 1990s. And now is this extraordinary community that provides so much to its members and way beyond. And I had some role to play in helping to create some of the foundation for that. So I'm very proud of that. What do I think I left undone? I guess I would say that there were it was when I left, it was just at the beginning of Angela's tenure, and I knew that she needed someone as a partner who would take her and support her in a way that I wasn't going to be able to do because of where I was in my life. So I have no hesitation about having left, but a little bit of me was sad not to be part of that journey because it's been an extraordinary journey.
Well, and even though you're not our executive director anymore, you're still enmeshed in our community. You're still a part of our community with relationships like you have with Jill, our facilitator, and others in our community. So something that I really appreciate.
Yeah, I still feel very connected to Central, and ironically, my parents, who had been members for a few years and then left to go back to a more traditional, smaller shul near their home, over the last couple of years have found great comfort, especially my mom, in being listening regularly to the Shabbat services and other programs of Central. So that's been a kind of a nice piece for me that, you know, she came home when it no longer mattered that there was a sense of commitment because of me, it was about her. So.
Wow. Oh, yeah. That's amazing. All right, so my last question for you is future focused. You know, you retired from Central, but retired in order to, not in order to, but were then hired in an executive role at Hebrew Union College. So you're not done. What do you still want to do or accomplish in your professional life? But also in your family and your personal life?
Yeah, so on my professional life, I left so that I could have a much more peripatetic life and do the kinds of things I wanted to do as a volunteer and professional and travel and family and so on. And until COVID, my husband and I did an enormous amount of traveling, and I did a fair amount of consulting, including a gig with Synagogue in Paris, which was particularly fun. But the last couple of years has been, I think for all of us, more sedentary. And so, the nature of my
volunteer and professional work have changed, although I continue to do that. And I want to continue to, as long as it makes sense, continue to have a connection professionally into the Jewish world. I love keeping a toe in and being able to engage with many different kinds of people and many different kinds of religious communities. On a personal level, I'd love to have grandchildren, which I don't yet have. But
no pressure,
you know,
girls.
No, oh, my kids all know it. Believe me, my kids all know it. So I'm not saying anything that they haven't heard, but I'm not allowed to say it to them. So, but other than that, and I'd like to go back to traveling as soon as that becomes possible, and of course to, you know, stay healthy.
Well, Kenya Hiratzon, may all of that be so, and soon.
Yes. Well, thank you. Thank you both.
I can't wait to add a few personal words. I want to make sure that we fill out the forms.
Let's finish the recording. So Jill, you'll hit end on the recording.
I will. Livia, thank you for always leading with your heart and your mind. We really miss you at Central. I'm very grateful to have you as such a close and dear friend and mentor. So wishing you everything good and many, many blessings.
Well,
and I'm going to hit the end. Thank you.